Welcome to Special Sauce, a Sirius Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we interview some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
It's really quite simple, Ed. It's like, if you're going to be working all day, every day in a kitchen, it might as well be palatial. Because Lupa was like moist and dirty
and dank.
It wasn't like industrialized. Back then, the, you know, the health department wasn't what they are today. And we got away with stuff.
This week, we're going to talk to chef, restaurateur, and now entrepreneur, Mark Ladner. Mark just shocked the food world by announcing he is leaving the only four-star Italian restaurant in New York City, Del Posto, to launch Pasta Flyer, a fast casual restaurant that he hopes is the first of many. Why would a four-star chef who's spent almost 20 years working for Mario Batali, the last 12 at Del Posto, chuck it all to open a restaurant that promises to process each order in less than a minute? That's one of many things we're going to find out today on Special Sauce. Mark Ladner is here. Welcome, my friend.
Thank you very much, Ed. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here. There's so many things I want to talk to you about. Pasta Flyer, leaving Del Posto.
Yep.
But what was life at the Ladner family table like?
Oh, wow. I was a typical 80s latchkey kid, I think was the terminology used at the time. My parents were divorced and both working hard and late. So my younger sister and I were responsible.
So you raised each other?
Yeah, yeah. We were fending for ourselves with frozen dinners and, explosive experimentations.
Wait. That's just a hanging chad. What kind of explosive experimentations?
Trying to cook together in a kitchen with no, real knowledge or supervision.
Where was this?
Made for some interesting. I grew up just outside of Cambridge, Massachusetts.
So it made for some interesting meals?
Yeah. I mean, we ate it regardless of the success. But yeah, it's certainly nothing to you could charge for.
And did either your mother or your father particularly care about food?
My mother did. When at the time of her life when she was more of a housewife, she cooked regularly, but I don't remember seasoning or like herbs and vegetation being a particularly important part of the.
You mean there was no table. Salt?
It was there, but it wasn't a very thoughtful application.
Chefs.
It was a different time,
Yeah.
It was a long time ago.
And so how did you get interested in food?
I always enjoyed working from a very young age. I did the whole, paper route thing and then
More than school, for example.
Oh, yeah. I was not a gifted student in any stretch of the imagination. But I always did enjoy work. I enjoyed the environment and the camaraderie. After paper routes, I got into caddying, which was a good summer job. And then once I was of age, I gravitated to the kitchen and just never left. So I chose this career long before it was
fashionable.
An enviable profession. I started culinary school in 1989. So that was pre, Food Network and all the rest.
And how old were you?
I was, like 18. Yeah.
So you basically went from high school to culinary school?
I took a year off in between to smoke a lot of pot and make a lot of pizza.
You made a lot of pizza?
Yeah, yeah. It was like a California-style wood brick oven pizza place in Harvard Square.
Oh, which one?
It was called Cafe Fiorello, which was in the Atrium building on Church
Street.
Oh,
yeah. I remember that place.
So yeah, I worked there full time, and I also worked for, they had another restaurant in Newbury Street that I also worked at, so I worked really hard when I wasn't smoking pot.
And did you love it?
I loved it. I did.
Like?
Always.
You just immediately connected to the work.
Yeah, even before that, starting at little sandwich shops or ice cream parlors, and I loved it all. Washing dishes, love it. In fact, I'm doing it right now. Yeah, can't get enough.
Things never change.
Yeah,
really.
It's just, you know, it can be really satisfying.
So you went to culinary school.
I did.
Johnson & Wales.
I did.
Which gave birth to the Food Network.
That I didn't know.
Yes,
did
because
know
it
that.
Was started by the Providence Journal Bulletin in Providence.
I did not know.
And
that.
They thought they had this repository of talent. Mm-hmm. At Johnson & Wales, which was the big cooking school in Providence. It was like, hey, we'll just fill the airwaves with chefs from Johnson & Wales.
At the time, there were only maybe a handful of cooking schools in the whole country, really.
What was cooking school like for you? Did you love that or did you find it limiting?
I didn't like it. It was very old school. It was hard to grasp how the fundamentals that we were learning were going to translate to, for example, the kitchens that I was working in at the time. Obviously, I would appreciate it much more now if I was to revisit those recipes and those techniques and the strategy of thought. But it was classical European militant style,
right?
Cooking education.
Yes, chef.
Exactly.
And what did your parents think of your decision to become a chef well before it was fashionable? Or
They were supportive. I mean, as I said, I wasn't a superstar student, so, you know, it wasn't like I was giving up other great opportunities. Yeah, at the time, it was, you know, it was one of the better, you know, culinary educations you could get. It actually did offer an associate's degree at the time, which was also unusual. And they had already seen me for a number of years working in kitchens and enjoying it and supporting myself. And
sounds like pretty self-reliant.
I started living on my own when I was 17.
So, wow.
Yeah.
That's unusual in this day and age.
Maybe. Maybe it is. It's expensive in this day and age. It wasn't, it wasn't so much back then.
And how did you meet Mario Batali?
I met him on the mean streets of New York. You know, the Greenwich Village sort of after work social scene. I mean, Mario was a figure and a notorious individual to be reckoned with in many eating and drinking establishments after 10 p.m. in Lower Manhattan in the early to mid 90s.
Uh-huh.
He also was friendly with people that I was working for at the time, so I met him that way. I was also one of the first fans of Poe.
Right. I was one of the first fans of Poe, too.
Yep.
I think that's maybe where we met.
Yeah. Perhaps, before Babbo, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I had always admired him because he really cracked the code on how to make what was considered at that time the 25 and under restaurant a really successful financial model.
Right.
No question.
With 32 seats.
Yeah. He lived a fantastic life. He was making a good living. He had lots of free time. They were closed, I think, 2 weeks in the winter and 2 weeks in the summer, which was very necessary because they were beating the crap out of the place with the amount of volume they were doing in the tiny place.
Think he once told me the record for one night was 210 covers.
On 30 seats.
On 30 seats.
Yeah.
So let's do the math there. You know, it's seven turns.
And there was a period of time when he was literally doing it by himself with maybe a dishwasher.
Really?
It was insane.
This is before
he
Andy.
Figured it out.
Before Andy Nusser.
Exactly, before Andy Nusser.
Who went on to be the opening chef at Babbo and that you worked for. And then went on to open Casamono and now is also involved with Terry Lodge.
Terry Lodge.
Yeah. So you met him. You were already working in serious New York restaurants.
I had sort of followed a parallel trajectory of that 25 and under thing. That's what I thought I was going to be. I thought I wanted to be a 25 and under chef, which was not something people necessarily aspired to be.
But right.
I worked with a great chef by the name of Scott Bryan, who had a restaurant called Indigo, which I opened with him, which was a great 25 and under restaurant. And then I went to work for a guy named Will Prunty, who is the chef of all the Jean-Claude Achiavelli restaurants in Soho, who was another titan of that.
Right.
That
he was sort
point.
Of a seminal figure in those value-driven French bistros in Soho in the 80s, right? Or the 90s?
It was the 90s.
Yeah.
It was the 90s. And then, you know, I wanted to try to finish this trifecta with Mario. And, you know, the enlightened being that he is, he had already moved on past that, realizing that that the future was bleak. at least for, you know.
Right. The downright dystopian.
The trajectory that he had in mind for his own career. So I was cooking Jean Georges the first year it was opened, and I wasn't particularly enjoying it. And I approached Mario to see if he would be interested in letting me help him open Babbo.
I bet there was a cocktail involved.
That was really
in the
good.
Approach.
No, no, he was very professional. It happened in the daytime, and there was no cocktails. We made up for that
later on.
But no, it was a great meeting. We met in the backyard at Poe on some wet lawn furniture, and then he took me to the Barnes & Noble on 8th Street and 6th Avenue.
Right, which doesn't exist anymore.
And bought me three books that I had to commit to memory.
Wow.
And
so what
still
were the
some
three
of
books?
My absolute favorites today. It was a Marcella Yazan book.
Right.
It was one of my all-time favorites, Lynn Rosetta Casper's Splendid Table.
Right. She just retired.
Yep.
And my friend Francis Lamb's taken over.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right, right. And then the very first, the seminal River Cafe cookbook.
Oh, yeah, I love that book.
So those three were just, it blew. I was just so excited.
That's great. And then he opened Babbo,
yes.
And you started working in that kitchen.
Yep, I opened Babbo with him and Joe in the summer. I think it was June of 98. And I worked there for 1 year and then started working on Lupa.
And that's
with Jason, as you know,
right.
was the manager at Poe for over 5 years. And he and I were close friends, and he was already working on Eno. Yeah, we partnered up and then ended up getting investment from Joe and Mario. And that's how that started, yeah.
You've ended up working with Mario for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
What are the sort of touchstones of the things that you learned from working for him for almost 20 years?
I mean, Mario is, you know, an incredibly gifted linguist, as we all know. He's also one of the best time managers that I've ever seen or met. And he is a consummate optimist, right?
Consummate optimist.
That's the thing that's
Don't we all want to be consummate optimists?
That's what's so incredible about him is that he is always pushing the joy in life. He
mm-hmm.
really knows how to, not only how to enjoy life, but how to manage it so that he can enjoy it as often as possible.
very well put.
I don't
put.
Think very many people have
mastered
have learned
that?
How to do that. Yeah, it's so hard. But he has figured it out. That guy, his life is just so fun.
Also, what people don't know about him, he is a gifted manager in many ways.
He is, and he's a pragmatist as well as an artist, which is an unusual thing to find. I mean, anyone that knows him knows that he's brilliantly intelligent and very well-read and educated on many, many different subjects. He's an artist and a businessman, which is an unusual left and right brain thing to find. But he's also a pragmatist, and he's very rational and logical, and he understands that restaurants and business and life needs to exist at the corner of art and commerce, right? That's
mm-hmm.
what he always professes, and I think that's really true, because if you lose sight of either one, there's no magic.
Yes, yes, and that balance is precarious but essential.
No question.
I mean, at least I've found. Whenever I find myself out of balance
yeah.
in either of those two things,
yeah.
and it was that way with Serious Eats
yeah.
through 10 years of...
For sure. Know,
it was just like... And it's so easy to get out of balance. But what's interesting is that you said that you started with Mario and you admired what he was doing at Poe, and you thought of yourself as an under $25 a person... you know, cheap eats kind of chef.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you opened Lupa, a Roman-style trattoria, which was sort of mid-priced, you know, moderately priced.
That would have been considered 25 and under at that time.
Before we go on, today's sponsor is Audible. a really cool app that offers an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more from leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine and newspaper publishers, and business information providers. They are now offering Special Sauce listeners, that's all of you, a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/SeriousEats and browse the selection. Then download a title, free, and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/SeriousEats. That's audible.com/SeriousEats and get started today. Chef, restaurateur, and now entrepreneur, Mark Ladner. When you decided you were going to open Del Posto, that's a whole other kettle of fish. You know, what was that for you? Like, how did that force you to change your thinking?
I had always had interest in fine dining, and I was paying attention. I mean, back then it was much easier to have your finger on the pulse of what was happening. You know, like the industry wasn't spliced in so many directions. Like, you can't keep track of all the great food in this country right now. It's impossible. At the time, it wasn't impossible. So I was paying attention and paying attention to Europe. And again, like the creative food scene wasn't at the time an international phenomenon, right? Nobody knew what was happening in China or Japan or even Australia,
right?
And also, there was no sense of American cuisine. I mean, there were people that tried, but it wasn't really resonating so much. Like, I mean, like an American Place. At that time, you know, Gramercy Tavern was starting to hit it pretty hard.
Right.
But arguably more European influence than it was American.
Right. And Italian food, you know, with the exception of Babbo and Poe, was also not that forward-thinking.
No. It was very, very traditional. It was incredibly simple and, in many cases, obscenely expensive in any of the good restaurants.
Like, right. Like all those restaurants on the Upper East Side.
Oh, yeah, like $30 for tomato. And it's still like that up there, you know,
right,
in some places. You know, that was more of like a hangout for the glitterati and that sort of thing.
Right.
It wasn't a common man's dining establishment.
Because you set out, you all were very clear that when you opened Del Posto, you set out to be the city's and therefore the country's first 4-star Italian restaurant.
Sure. Well, I mean, Mario and Joe, when I first started talking about it with them, they had other plans. I mean, Joe was working on the lease even perhaps before Babbo even came to fruition.
Joe Bastianich, Mario's partner.
And he, I think, had envisioned more of like a Carmine's kind of situation with Lydia and Mario involved. And then as all of their...
We should say that Carmine's is this sort of, I call it trough style Southern Italian American eating.
Smack dab in the middle of Times Square.
Right. How many meatballs can one person consume?
Yeah. So, you know, that's how it started. And then as the project got closer and closer, the trajectory of all three of their careers, including Lydia's.
Lydia Bastianich is Joe's mother, the founder of Felidia, and not just the first important woman Italian chef in this country, but maybe one of the first Italian chefs of any gender.
Yeah, she was certainly a pioneer and continues to be. And brought a lot of ingredients and product to the American market that didn't exist prior.
Sure.
So then they decided that they wanted this to be more ambitious, and they asked me if I would do it, and it seemed like a good opportunity that I couldn't pass up. It's really quite simple, Ed. It's like, if you're going to be working all day, every day in a kitchen, it might as well be palatial.
Is that, maybe that should be an epitaph.
Because Lupo was like moist and dirty.
And dank.
It wasn't like industrialized. You know, it's a townhouse in the village. And back then, the health department wasn't what they are today. And we got away with stuff.
I remember going to see the Salumi, and bringing my friend Brian Polson, who was writing the Salumi book, and he came up and
what a great book.
Yeah, and his face was ashen. He was wow,
they're going to kill someone,
right? Exactly.
Yeah.
So the idea of moving to a palatial kitchen, which is, I mean, I think that the Del Posto kitchen, we should say, is probably 20 yards by 20 yards, maybe even bigger.
It's massive. I mean, there's almost 200 employees. Like a busy night service is 25 chefs, so it's a lot to orchestrate. But again, it didn't happen overnight. And unlike many of my peers, I focused all of my energy on only that one restaurant for close to 12 years, which is not something that many people with aspirations or real promise have.
Sure, but it was also a huge nut to crack.
It was, and it did.
That's
take a
not
long time.
Like, oh, I'm going to open a little trattoria, you know. Like,
and it wasn't always good. I mean, in all honesty, you know, it took us a really.
All right, dude. We just had some news made. It wasn't always good, but
I
used to talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, I was frustrated for a long time, and it took a long time for us to find, you know, a style that resonated with guests and that made sense, and you know, everything else. Took several years.
And it probably had to. You were trying to do something that you had never done.
Yeah, there was no precedent. I mean, during the building phase, we were going around, you know, Joe and I looking at lots of different places from La Caravelle to Le Bernardin. There were certainly no Italian restaurants, even in Italy, that were operating on this scale, and not really very many French ones either.
Yeah.
So we had difficulty finding a precedent to study.
Yeah. Was your vision, was your collective vision, the idea that you were going to elevate Italian food so that even though people were going to pay like they were going to a French restaurant, that they were going to get an experience, food that they had never seen before, presented in a way that Italian restaurants were not used to presenting food.
Mm-hmm. I started to develop techniques on how to manipulate perception, right? Mm. Because we knew that we wanted the food to really still resonate in a way that felt familiar and felt satisfying.
The way Italian food traditionally had.
Absolutely, absolutely. Right. So it wasn't about necessarily changing the food, but changing the perception on how people viewed and experienced the food. And then with all the fineries and all the other service trappings, as they say, you know, that also took time because, you know, there is a lot of Italian, you know, service wares out there that are great. And then I started developing relationships with some of those companies, and they started working with us, and I started educating myself on what that meant, and then how to make, like, you know, if you buy something nice at Del Posto, you don't buy one of them, you buy 50, or you buy, and then you get into silver and porcelain and crystal, and all this stuff is fragile.
Right. So you were trying to elevate the experience and try to manipulate people's perceptions of Italian food using great ingredients, ingredients that were sourced locally.
Yes.
I remember the bread basket was unparalleled. I called it the best bread basket in New York.
Maybe for a period of time it may have been.
I mean, obviously, but when I wrote that, I was sure that was the case.
It was a lot. I mean, it was a lot of amenity to give a person, you know, 5 pieces of bread per person for free as soon as you sat down.
Right.
That's a lot. That's a lot to give away.
Did people take to it right away?
I think they did. I mean, there's still, not just in this town, but anywhere, you know, there's still that thing in the back of people's minds where volume is value.
Right.
We wanted to embrace at least part of that ideology. And, you know, in order to be able to justify prices, it can't feel like what you can get at, you know,
at
the corner trattoria.
Right. You were managing a staff of how many?
It was a lot, probably with like dishwashers and porters. It was around 60 people or something. But I mean, certainly I wasn't doing it by myself.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is it was no longer the case that you were touching every plate of food or tasting every plate of food.
No, no. I realized early on that, you know, you had to subdivide departmentally in order to be able to manage effectively. And then, you know, I was talking with and working closely with department heads, and then they were, in effect, it was actually Alice Waters that set me straight one night at Rao's, where she was like, why don't you just make every line an independent kitchen with an independent chef? And I was like, well, no, you crazy lady. But she was right.
Really?
And, I mean, I did it slightly differently because it still had to sort of filter through me so that it felt like a unified, you know, restaurant and statement, and the style couldn't be disparate in that way. But that was really the only way that I was able to manage such a overwhelming, you know.
Yeah, thing. Staff.
Right.
Yeah, that's a big thing. And I remember it did take a few years, and I wrote on Serious Eats, this dream has sort of been realized, but it was a few years in, if you remember. You know,
yeah, when you came for that lunch, and then that was the beginning. That's really when it started to take off. We started to really get positive momentum for the first time, where it felt like a cohesive thing, right?
Right.
I very clearly remember that lunch.
Yes, I do too. Mm-hmm. I still taste that lunch. It was awesome.
Yeah.
When you set out to get the stars and you got them, you didn't get them the first time around, right?
No, I mean, that was Frank Bruni reviewed us when we were about 3 months old, maybe. And I mean, we were lucky to have gotten 3 stars, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly you could have had a 3-star experience there at the time, just maybe not every time.
And when you got the 4 stars, was it a cause for celebration or relief?
It was celebration. I mean, I went through a really dark time after that. I don't feel like I handled it very well. Brooks and I both were really overwhelmed by it. We were shocked.
Brooks Headley was the pastry chef who now has
Superiority Burger.
Superiority Burger, the most famous veggie burger joint in the world.
No question.
So you were both overwhelmed, and you said you were sort of going through a dark point.
Yeah. We were having a really hard time sort of coming to grips with and placing what that meant for us and our careers. And yeah, it was very, very unexpected. What I hoped would happen was I would be able to get an opportunity to have a conversation with Sam Sifton from The Times, who was the reviewer at the time, and say, Sam, what do you think that we could do to improve what we offer here to eventually maybe get 4 stars at some point in the not too distant future? We didn't expect to actually get it.
Wow.
Although I do remember, you know, pretty successfully micromanaging his visits, and he was a joy to cook for and serve because, similarly to Mario, he is somebody that enjoys life.
Yes, he does. He was the one who got me writing for The Times.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's
an incredible guy. And he really liked, for a reviewer, he really liked to go out and do his job. And he would engage the staff and he would talk to them. And that was very unusual, at least in my experience, trying to profile reviewers over the years.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, but yet when you got it, it sounds like you say you didn't handle it very well.
It didn't change anything about our day-to-day, operations, except that people sort of treated the restaurant a little differently. They were a little more respectful, maybe.
Right.
When they came in, they ate a little more thoughtfully, and they took a little bit more time, and it definitely changed the way the public treated the experience while they were there. But from a kitchen perspective, we weren't doing anything really much different.
But it sounds like it sort of wreaked havoc on your emotional and psychological equilibrium.
No question at all. Yeah, no question.
How did that manifest itself?
Well, mostly I was just drinking really heavily. And I've since stopped for a number of years. But so that certainly didn't help.
that's a negative manifestation.
As I like the wisdom I like to share with the young people these days is that substance abuse is not a sustainable lifestyle choice. It can be fun for a while, even a long while, but it doesn't work forever.
Yeah, yeah.
It catches up to you.
Yes. Jazz musicians learn that.
Yeah.
I just saw this great documentary about incredibly talented trumpet player Lee Morgan, who was shot by his wife at Slugs in the East Village between sets because his girlfriend was also there. And anyway, there's this incredible documentary. So, and he was very badly strung out for a very, very long time. And the wife actually put him back together. Because he, too, was enjoying, he didn't know how to handle his success, which came very early.
Yeah.
So then you get the James Beard Award, right? So that's like the cherry on top of the sundae, right?
Sure. That was only a few years ago, so I was already an adult.
Yeah, you were already an adult. And how much pride do you now, looking back, do you take from that experience?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's incredibly surreal. I never imagined having opportunity to have access to this level of success, especially in fine dining. It wasn't something that I necessarily set out to do. I certainly could never have done it on my own without the support and resource and facility that Mario and Joe and Lydia gave me at Del Posto, and being able to focus on my craft rather than, operating the business or dealing with, all of the other aspects that make a place work. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've never been one really for the spotlight. I'm not interested in television or celebrity or anything like that.
It's so interesting. I've always thought that's one of the reasons that you and Mario could work so well together, because you really have no interest in being a star.
Right. It's true.
Probably still don't.
No, I don't at all. No, I mean, I like what I do, and I find great satisfaction in doing it, and it's nice to be recognized and all that. But no, I wouldn't want to be like Mario. But I mean, that's ridiculous to say, because nobody could be like Mario except Mario.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, perhaps that is part of why we've been able to succeed for so long together.
Yeah, for sure. We haven't even gotten to Pastafly.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, at the top of your game, right? You've won the Beard Award. You've gotten 4 stars. You made a decision to walk away from that kitchen, that cavernous kitchen.
The story of Pastaflyer, Mark Ladner's next venture, next time on Special Sauce with Ed Levine.
You'll be astonished. This pasta takes 10 seconds to cook.
That's awesome. All right. We'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.
Thank you.